The Big Marsh was a source of bounty for wildlife, native people, and settlers. When it was drained, it offered up fertile soil. But what was lost? This hour, we'll explore the landscape of the Prairie Pothole region. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with Sherry Register, author of The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape. Her family has lived near the Big Marsh area for generations. We'll talk about how the land has been changed and the ripple effects of those changes. We'll also talk about wetland reconstruction with wetland scientist Judy Joyce, founder and president of Earthview Environmental Incorporated. And we'd also like to hear from you. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We love lakes, rivers, streams, and even ponds. But in the Midwest, wetlands, marshes, fens, we have diligently worked to remove these from our landscape. This hour, we'll talk about wetlands and also wetland restoration. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Judy Joyce, founder and president of Earthview Environmental Incorporated. But first, Sherry Register's family has lived near Albert Lea, Minnesota for generations. In her latest book, she writes about the landscape in the area and the changes that have taken place since her family first settled there. The book is The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape, and Sherry Register is here with me now. Hello, Sherry.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And even though when you were a child, the landscape had already been changed dramatically, it was not recognizable if you look back to it, to what your great-great-grandparents would have seen in Minnesota. But you have fond memories of this environment, the marshy soil. Tell me a little bit about what you fell in love with as a child.
Well, I feel like a marsh, a wetland, is kind of my primeval landscape, that not only have I kind of inherited this love of wetlands, but I grew up near a little slough that was a remnant of a much larger wetland that has since been diminished even more and paved over and turned into a strip mall. But what I remember particularly is the sound of the red-winged blackbirds, that trill that they do. I remember the feel of cattails. I remember the droplets of water that were in the air. The air was much moister in my childhood than it is now. And it was a whole kind of sensory environment that gave me my first childhood sense of security.
The area that you grew up in is part of the Prairie Pothole region, which covers a lot of Minnesota, the western part of the state, southern part of the state, and also dips down into Iowa and, of course, extends up into Canada. For people who aren't familiar with what characterizes that region and what characterized that region prior to settlement, can you tell us a little bit about the ecology?
Well, I lived or grew up at the very eastern edge of that region on the Oak Savanna, which is the transitional landscape between the big woods, the hardwood forest that covered so much of the eastern half of the U.S. before European settlement, and the tall grass prairie to the west. And so what I grew up with was a rolling landscape, a glacially formed landscape with little outcroppings of bur oak trees all around. So the bur oak tree, for me, the profile of that tree is one of the most beautiful images I can ever carry in my mind. It was a landscape that was just teeming with wildlife. Because of this rolling terrain, there were low points that didn't drain anywhere. This terrain sat a little higher than the land around it. And so these low points didn't drain, but they became wetlands, and they grew with reeds and marsh vegetation, and were just teeming with birds, with muskrats, with mink, all sorts of wildlife at the time of European settlement.
And at the time of European settlement, that was a real draw for the settlers, right? Because there was so much wildlife there.
It was. I mean, they had their farming. They especially plowed up the prairie part of the landscape, the higher lands, and grew diversified products. They started with wheat initially, which didn't last for more than a few decades, but barley, oats, and eventually corn. And they grazed cattle in the meadows at the edge of the marshes, where it was wet in the wet seasons and dry in the dry seasons. But it was a subsistence living, and they depended very heavily on the marsh as a protein source. They fished it, they hunted and trapped, they hunted for birds, especially the waterfowl that would come through in the spring and fall migrations. And they also hayed. They fed their cattle on the marsh reeds that dried out over the summer. So it was a life that was lived in concert with the landscape and not always vying to overcome nature.
Well, and if we look back further, pre-settlement, it was also a very important part of the landscape for the native people in the area.
Very much so. This particular area of the Big Marsh was hunting land primarily for the Dakota from the north, for the Sac and Fox from the south, and eventually for the Winnebago or Ho-Chunk, who were moved out to a reservation just west of there along the Blue Earth River. So there was lots of activity in the area, lots of human activity, and lots of remnants of that life going way, way back, even 10,000 years to its formation.
And even beyond the hunting, there was also the harvesting that very likely took place
right.
in the Big Marsh as well.
There were plants that grew within the marsh, bulb-like plants. The Dakota women particularly, would wade out into the marsh and dig out with their feet and then lift their feet up and grab the bulbs with their hands. And they were a tuber-like bulb that grew in the marsh, and lots of other kinds of, possibilities for forage, too.
Now, you have looked back in your family for generations, and they've lived in this region for a very long time. Were you already doing genealogical research before you started thinking about the history of this marsh, or is this something that went hand in hand for you, the land and the people?
Well, I didn't start genealogical research until fairly recently, about the time that other people started in their life, when you get past middle age and you start thinking about your own mortality. But I was always interested as a child in my origins, my antecedents, although I have to admit I was more interested in the Danish side of my family, my mother's family, than I was in my father's. And this book is about my father's side. They were Yorkers who came out in a kind of incremental move west and arrived in this area in 1855, among the very first Europeans who settled there. But what made me interested in this story was I was doing research for a different book a while back, a book called Packing House Daughter that came out 16 years ago. And I ran across an article in a Farmer Labor Party newspaper from the 1930s that was headlined, "Connivings of Dishonest Men Cheat Nature as Well as Fellow Beings, Writer Avers." And it turned out the writer of that article was my great-grandfather. And so I just became intrigued with this cryptic story he was telling me about some misdeeds that were done in the drainage of this landscape. And so then I started work on finding out what the story was and finding my family's own part in the resistance to the drainage.
Well, let's go back and talk about the landscape as it was before the drainage started taking place. You've called your book The Big Marsh, but this was a large area, the Big Marsh and Rice Lake. Try to describe it for me.
It was 18,000 acres of wetland. That's a huge wetland, one of the largest in this part of the country. It covered the northeast corner or northeast, almost the northeast quadrant of what became Fribourne County in southern Minnesota. And Rice Lake at the western end of the marsh was the deepest part. It was deep enough to support fish life and so on. And so it was heavily used for fishing as well as hunting. And then the marsh, a marsh sort of exists in concentric circles. There's the deep part, and then there are other layers or other forms of life as you go out to the edge, and eventually the tall grass prairie begins. And so this marsh consisted of all of these different forms and degrees of aquatic life. So at the edge, you would have the wet meadow where in the drier parts of the summer, as the heat went up, you could graze your cattle on meadow grasses. But this, you know, it was huge and kind of meandering. And we actually got a map of the marsh off the original survey maps, the public land survey that was done in 1854. And when I show it to people or when people open the book and see it, they're just so surprised at how much area this marsh covered. And it was one of many wetlands in the county, particularly the eastern half of the county. So there were other large wetlands too, but this was the biggest.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, this was kind of a draw for settlers because of all of the wildlife. Also, you write about how Minnesota was known for its lakes from the very start of settlement, that
right.
this was good publicity for Minnesota. But it seems like we valued, even then, a certain kind of lake
right.
over other kinds of lakes. And we're going to have to take a short break, and we'll be back. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm talking with Sherry Register. Her most recent book is called The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape. It tells the story of a landscape near Albert Lea, Minnesota, where her family has lived for generations. Also, later in the hour, we'll talk about wetland restoration in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about wetlands in the Midwest, specifically in the Prairie Pothole region, which covers part of northern Iowa and a great deal of Minnesota. Sherry Register's family has lived near or in that region for many generations, and she's written about a specific marsh, the Big Marsh. The Story of a Lost Landscape is the name of her most recent book. And Sherry, just before the break, we were talking about how Minnesota has always been known for its lakes. That's always been, they even did publicity to get settlers to come to Minnesota by writing about all of these amazing lakes and sending word back east. But we do seem to have, even then, very specific standards about what kinds of lakes we
right.
love and what kinds of wetlands we consider to be a little bit in our way.
Right. The publicity that was sent out, you know, by the Minnesota state government, by the railroads, by land speculators, talked about clear, crystalline sheets of water. That's a term that recurs throughout these publications. And they meant a lake that had nothing growing on its surface, no emergent vegetation, but was just a nice, sparkly, flat, glistening surface of water. And they're around these two forms of water, the crystalline lakes and the marshes, a class difference really emerges. The crystalline sheets of water were more suitable for recreation or just for contemplation of beauty. And those often became town sites. The more urban people, professional people, merchants, and so on, would settle around these sheets of water. But for the farmers who lived among the wetlands, the marsh was not only beautiful, but it was also a very practical part of their life. And so we see already a class difference emerge, and differences in the way land was priced and valued in relation to these different bodies of water. And in Fribourne County, where you can see this difference pretty clearly, it's ironic that some of those clear crystalline sheets of water began their lives as marshes, and then they were dammed up and flooded so that you couldn't see the vegetation. So Fountain Lake, which is this gorgeous little, well, it's not so little, gorgeous lake right in the middle of Albert Lea, the gem of the people who live there, has a very different character from what it did when it was originally a wetland that was pretty much overgrown with wild rice.
And it takes quite a bit of upkeep to keep it that way, too,
doesn't it? It certainly does. It's being dredged all the time. But I do have to say I'm so happy. My favorite lake in Albert Lea was the one I could walk to most quickly from my house, Pickerel Lake. And the watershed district just received a big grant to help restore and depollute Pickerel Lake, which is a lake that is surrounded by wetlands. It's, you know, it's kind of clear in the middle, but it's very much a wetland ecosystem. And they're going to restore some of the wetlands that filter that lake water around the edges.
Why was the big marsh drained? I mean, we know that so many little wetlands all over Iowa, all over Minnesota, all over the Midwest were tiled and drained for farmers so that they didn't have those big wet spots in their fields so they could reclaim or claim the land for agriculture. But big marsh, I mean, that wasn't part of somebody's farm.
Right.
That was a plan. So how did that plan come about?
Well, most of the land in the Big Marsh was owned by the railroads. It had been given to the railroads early on with the idea that it would someday be drained to help finance the building of the railroads across the country. Well, in 1890, this railroad land, much of it, 6,000 acres of it, was purchased by a man named Putnam Dana McMillan, who was a real estate developer in Minneapolis. And he didn't live on the land ever, but what he wanted to do was create a big experimental farm that would really be the beginnings of industrial agriculture in Fribourne County. And so he was the one who took the initiative to the drainage so that he could have this big multi-thousand acre farm. And then there was another man who came in whose name was Bryant Barber. He was a banker from Polo, Illinois. And I still don't know, in all the research I did, I still don't know the connection, how he ended up interested in this Minnesota land. But then he bought some of McMillan's, and then he bought the rest. And the two of them then made this effort to have the land drained with public financing. You know, it's like an early analog to sports stadiums. They wanted the county to finance the drainage and then assess the farmers along along the route of all the ditches who presumably would benefit from this drainage. And it was very highly opposed by the county commission and by the farmers who lived around the marsh and by others in the county who would end up in some fashion having to pay for this big enterprise. And it took from 1890 until 1909 for the drainage to actually be done. And what I've traced are all the legal machinations that include the rewriting of Minnesota state drainage legislation to take the authority for this land away from the county and put it in the hands of a judge who would rule in favor of the big landowners.
Did the smaller landowners in the area, did they try to fight back?
They did try to fight back. They hired their own lawyer, who eventually was hired away by the big landowners. They wrote petitions. They did, you know, everything short of sabotage. At least I haven't read about any sabotage, but there may have been some that went unreported. But they protested and protested. They held meetings. They came to all the court hearings and the county commission hearings on this project and raised their voices and tried really hard to stop it. But in the end, it was, you know, wealth and political influence that prevailed.
And how did it work? Once they drained the marsh, what were the results like?
Well, they were not good at first because they dug ditches and they also reamed out Turtle Creek, which was a beautiful natural creek that flowed from the marsh into the Cedar River in Austin. And they reamed that out and turned it into a ditch and then had all these auxiliary ditches that drained in, but they didn't tile the land at that point. And so it was not really a fully successful drainage. And in time, those landowners kind of died out, actually. And what happened is in the early 1920s, the Payne Investment Company from Omaha, Nebraska, came in and bought up the land and did another drainage and did complete tiling of the land. And what was left then was this very fertile peat soil that was suitable for vegetable farming and sugar beet farming. And the Payne Investment Company recruited Dutch farmers, Dutch Americans mostly at this point. Not only did they have to be Dutch, but they had to belong to the Dutch Reformed Church. And they created this vegetable growing colony called Hollandale, that the town is still there, but it's now corn and soybeans. And they expected that this vegetable colony would flourish for all time. But what happens is when you take the water source away from peat soil, it just dries up. And so they needed fertilization and so on like everywhere else in the county. And so Hollandale is not what it used to be. And the land floods a lot. The water doesn't soak in the way it would on other types of soil. And so it's been a very difficult process of farming for the people who live right in the old marsh.
I'm talking with Sherry Register. Her book is called The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape. And Sherry, on this program, we often talk about wildlife and wild places in this part of the world. And we know that the story is that due to many different pressures, so many different species basically disappeared from the land, and many of them are now making a comeback. But beyond that, which, you know, part of that was draining these wetlands, and there were many other influences as well, what do you see as the repercussions of draining the big marsh?
Well, I think the loss of wildlife habitat is a huge one, and little pockets of it are being restored, and it's amazing that the birds come back even to those little oases along their migratory path. But also I think climate change is a big one, that he was the postman in Twin Lakes, a little town south of Albert Lea, who was kind of an early ecologist, and he predicted that the land would dry out, that things would be different if we did this drainage. We would not have this cycle of evaporation and so on that you get when you have a lot of water around. And he turned out to be right in a lot of ways. The other thing that's happened is that the monoculture that's taken over, or the biculture, I guess, of corn and soybeans has depleted the soil. It has also, the ditching and tiling has polluted the creeks and rivers. So the Minnesota River is a main pollutant because this is partly it drains into the Minnesota River, partly into the Cedar in Iowa, and it all goes to the Mississippi. And so my home country is very much responsible for adding to that dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, you also mentioned that the land around Hollandale floods frequently. You write about the floods in the Midwest on a much grander scale. And, of course, many of us have lived through some really dramatic flooding. And these major flood events seem to be much more common, happening more frequently. And draining that marsh and so many others, that's a part of that, too.
Because they were the areas that held the water until it took its natural course downstream. And I recently heard from a man who has a draining company, does ditching and tiling in Hollandale, who said, and he's lived there all his life, he was born there, Dutch guy, and he said that land cannot manage a rainfall of more than 5 inches. And these days we're getting these huge heavy rainfalls, so 5 inches is not infrequent or unusual. And the people who work in the watershed district and who oversee the drainage work really, really hard to try to restrain that water. But we do get those big floods, like, what was it, 2008?
Yeah.
I think the huge flood that was so devastating.
Why do you think it's important to understand the history of this marsh, of this area?
Well, because we have so many myths about it. I mean, we think that we live in a very natural environment. I think Minnesotans particularly live with that myth that we are a kind of pristine, and we're not at all. We've dramatically transformed that environment. The other myth is that everybody hated wetlands, that they were sources of pestilence and nobody wanted them there. And we end up blaming the settlers and the farmers for drainage when in fact it was not them. It was the big land speculators who were much more influential in trying to, as they say, reclaim that fertile land underneath the water. And so we need to know the truth of this. And so my story is just one incident of how this came about, that it was not a self-evident thing to do, to drain those wetlands.
I find it very interesting that there was that much resistance among the people who lived in the area, because on a smaller scale, I mean, a lot of farmers had a wet patch in their property and, yes, tiled it and drained it. So that is a part of the story. But to transform the landscape in this dramatic a way, to drain this large a marsh, I am surprised to learn that there was that much resistance among the farmers and the other people who lived in the area.
Yeah, and that story is just lost. I mean, I had to uncover that. I had to do 9 years of research to pull that out, mostly out of the local newspapers, particularly the weekly rural newspapers, and then some other private sources that I could find. But people don't know this history. I mean, we think of it as a kind of victory story that, you know, we conquered nature and created this fertile corn belt of ours. But no, there was resistance all along the way. And there were some farmers who didn't drain those little low spots. Like my dad, when I was a child, used to tell me. He said, my granddad said that God put the slough there for a reason, and so he didn't drain his own.
You dedicate the book to the birds. Why? Mm-hmm.
Because they were the initial victims of this drainage, and seeing them come back is the most wonderful thing, to think that even species that are so thoroughly endangered have enough resilience to begin breeding again and to find these areas that were their original homes. It's just such an amazing story. I was up at Crex Meadows in Wisconsin not long ago, and there was another landscape that was drained and that was used commercially to harvest reeds for making furniture and carpets. And beginning in the 1940s, they started restoring that wetland. And now it's this big, beautiful place. And there were sandhill cranes and trumpeter swans and all kinds of ducks coming back with the migration, and it was wonderful.
Well, Sherry, we're going to take a short break. Please stay with us. Sherry Register is the author of The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape. And we'll talk more about wetland reconstruction in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about wetlands in the Midwest and wetland restoration. With me is Sherry Register. She is the author, most recently, of The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape. She wrote about this landscape and her family's history living alongside it near Albert Lea, Minnesota. And joining us now is Judy Joyce. She's the founder and president of Earthview Environmental Incorporated, a wetland services and natural resource consulting organization. She is a wetland scientist. The company's located in Coralville, Iowa, and she's with us today. Hello, Judy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Sherry and I have been talking a lot about the oak savanna and also the prairie pothole region. And the prairie pothole region does reach down into northern Iowa. But beyond that region, there were a lot of small wetlands all across the state of Iowa originally. Can you give me an idea of what the landscape here would have been like pre-settlement?
Yes. You know, over the last, 200 years, Iowa's lost 90% plus of its wetlands. And we like to think of Iowa as the prairie state, and it is a prairie state. But what we don't realize that a lot of those prairies were wet prairies and marshes. And so if you think about going across the landscape, 150 years ago, you would be walking through sloughs, you would be, tall grass prairies, wet prairies, squishy areas in the spring, dry areas in the summer. And, many of the streams and stuff that we see right now were more swales and more, lower wetland areas.
So, of course, we know that there are tiles beneath many, many, maybe almost all of the farm fields in the state of Iowa. And communities also drained land to use that land for construction, right? I mean, we dramatically changed the face of our state.
Yeah, with tiling and ditching, that really lowered the water table and took the water off the surface as quick as possible and channeled it, through these ditches and straightened streams as quick as we could to get it away. And that was really the goal at the time.
Well, and that's something that I remember not only seeing farmers work on tiling, which, of course, it still happens today, but the straightening of streams was something that I saw a lot of as I was growing up 30 years ago in Iowa. And give me an idea of the purpose of that and how much of that was done with these little streams and creeks that cross our fields.
There's some great, interesting stories out there of, and I've seen some old advertisements where you could buy dynamite from the local store to blow up your creek to get it to go straight. And, you know, you can just imagine that, you know, you want to farm an area, you want to get that water off as quickly as possible, you want to increase your acres, your producible acreage, and so you are, you know, you're going to straighten that, you're going to, you know, make a nice clean edge, and again, that straightening is going to get that water off there quickly, and it's going to provide you more tillable acreage.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that straight edge. Sherry, you write about that as well, because, of course, we have this grid system in the Midwest and in much of the nation, right, really, but particularly in Iowa, we have this amazing grid, which, of course, made it possible to sell land and organize communities. But I think it also appealed to our sort of sense of order as human beings. Do you think that grid system influenced how we changed the landscape? Sherry?
Yeah. Oh, me. Oh. Yeah. Yes, it definitely did. I mean, the whole notion that you would take a rolling landscape that's part dry, part watery, and divide it into square sections is just silly when you think about it. I do have a chapter in the book about the public land survey and just about how difficult it was for those surveyors to be wading through this water trying to draw straight lines to distinguish one township from another and one section from another. And it was this peculiar vision of Thomas Jefferson and others that this would be a way to make things equal and to give the land a price, to set a value on the land. And that's really when it happened, is when they divided it into sections. And you notice it especially driving down from Minnesota through Iowa, that the highways all run along section lines. So you're turning all the time when it would be more efficient to just go straight.
Well, it does make it easy to navigate. But Sherry, I'm sure that was frustrating. I mean, I'll ask you, Judy. I mean, I'm sure that was part of the frustration for farmers, too, because if their land included some of these wetland areas, these low spots, but their section was created on this grid system, I'm sure it was a very frustrating problem for a lot of farmers who did want to get and do want to get the most out of their land.
Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, another reason for straightening is putting up fences and distinguishing between where my property ends and your property begins. That's much easier if you've got a straight line than if you've got a stream channel that's meandering around, or if you've got a wetland that floods periodically and changes over time, or any of that, just to come up with a defined line that you could say, this is mine, this is yours.
So let's talk about, obviously you work in wetland reconstruction, but what are some of the problems that people now identify and now see because of the practices that we had in the past that are leading them to think, oh, I need to actually invest in restoring a little bit of what was there before? What are the main problems, Judy?
You know, I think actually you just kind of hit on it with the grid system, is that water does not flow on a grid. It flows in a watershed, and watersheds cross you know, individual property boundaries and political boundaries. So if you're trying to do a restoration project, it might go beyond that city limits, it might go beyond that county limits, and to look at where that water is falling and flowing and moving on a watershed approach, you're dealing with many, many different jurisdictions. So if you're trying to do a restoration project, especially on a larger scale, you know, sometimes it's hard to say I want to invest in a wetland that isn't on my property, or isn't in my county, or isn't in my state even, you know, even though I'm going to get benefits from it.
Well, and I'm sure that it does create a lot of difficult negotiations with neighbors as well.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So give me an idea of some of the kinds of projects you have worked on, because restoring a wetland doesn't sound like a very easy thing to do after, let's say, 100 years of draining and moving soil and maybe even applying dynamite.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, early wetland restoration efforts kind of used the same principles we would use for making ponds, where, you know, we knew how to build something that would hold water year-round, or we knew how to get the water away. But with wetlands, you know, if you're trying to mimic that natural system, you want these seasonally saturated areas that are going to be wet in the spring or during wet times and then dry out. And that is a little bit more tricky from a design perspective, trying to emulate these natural systems. On top of that, you know, looking at the past and what these wetlands look like, you know, can be a good model. But when your watershed has changed and the amount of water the land's received and your climate's changing, that even makes it a little bit more difficult. So we can't just look in the past. We have to predict how things are going to behave in the future.
And how long a project would it be to work on restoring a wetland? Because it's not just a matter of breaking tiles or removing tiles, right?
Right, correct. I mean, you can just start with the vegetation. You know, once you get the hydrology established, the next step is to get that vegetation, you know, going. And depending on what type of wetland you're trying to create, whether it's, you know, if it's a forested wetland, you might end up, you know, it might take 40, 50, 100 years before you get a forest. If it's a prairie, the initial plants may come up, but then to develop that prairie root system could take tens of years. And then if you're trying to actually restore it to what the wetland soils were, those soils took thousands of years to form. So whether, you know, you can get something that functions, but it, you know, whether you're going to restore with what was there before is it's going to take much longer.
And those streams that have been straightened are part of this process as well. Do you actually work on trying to allow a stream to follow what would be a more natural path?
Yeah, that is a big push lately, is to try to reconnect streams to their floodplains. So, you know, typically you look at a lot of Iowa streams and the wall of the stream, the bank of the stream is vertical and the water rushes through it and then occasionally floods because we try to put levees in there so it doesn't flood so often. Well, really trying to reconnect that stream so that you do get flooding events. You do get water brought onto that landscape adjacent to the stream, and so you are reconnecting it to the floodplain. And in the process, you are also creating wetlands in that process.
Now, of course, there's been a lot of conversation in Iowa, and there will be a great deal more conversation in Iowa about water quality, but also about the loss of topsoil and the runoff that goes eventually into that dead zone into the Gulf of Mexico, and the kinds of nutrients that are making their way down these creeks and into our rivers and into the Mississippi River. Do you find, Judy, that you are hearing from a lot of people who now understand these wetland ecosystems a little bit better and understand their benefits better? Is this a real growth in understanding and desire to restore them? Or is this still a pretty small percentage of people who want to do this?
You know, there has been a change. There's been a push to do these restoration projects on this watershed approach and not just piecemeal it with a little project here and a little project there. And then on top of that, the data shows that wetlands do so much work for us. I mean, nature has just learned to take up nutrients, to treat that water over time. And so, you know, what we try to make in a wastewater treatment system is an artificial, you know, environment that the wetlands, you know, do for us naturally. And I think with more data out there on how these wetlands are treating the water, how much you can do that more cost effectively, I think that is, you know, that is something that's definitely becoming, you know, more popular. I think there's still more growth in this area, but I think people are taking it more seriously.
Well, and Sherry, you write about some little remnants of sloughs and wetlands near you that now people are paying a lot more attention to and maybe enhancing that landscape. Do you feel like there are lots of hidden little pockets on farms around Minnesota and Iowa?
I'm just beginning, now that this book has come out, I'm just beginning to learn about some. People will report to me that a particular farmer in the Hollandale area, for example, is letting a part of his land revert to wetland. And so I do see them cropping up here and there. But I think it is important, too, to hear what Judy's saying about the difficulty of kind of recreating nature that took thousands of years to develop. That it's not an easy thing, but at least it's very worthwhile to make that beginning.
Well, and when we talk about prairie restoration in Iowa, there are some people who think that if they just allow the grass to grow or the weeds to grow, that the prairie grasses will come back. And sometimes there are remnants that are surprise people, I think. But Judy, as far as the natural vegetation that would be in a wetland area, is it there? Can it come back, or is that something that we have to very purposely try to replant?
The answer is sometimes. sometimes it is there, but it's buried. You know, when the prairies were ripped off, a lot of dirt moved around, and all of our stream valleys are, you know, literally feet of material that buried the previous topsoil. And there's been some research done where they've dug down through that pre-settlement alluvium or post-settlement alluvium, and down just try to see if there's actually a seedbed there. And in some cases, they have found a seedbed, which is very interesting. But in most cases, because we have so many exotic species that are aggressive, that don't have their natural predators, you know, in order for us to try to recreate something, we need to become, you know, the predators of those invasives. We need to help. We need to jumpstart it to get it going.
When you say that 90% plus of the wetlands in Iowa have been drained over the centuries, I guess now, I mean, Judy, with the work that you're doing and other people are doing to restore wetlands, do you feel hopeful, or does it feel like you're up against something that's kind of impossible?
You know, there's days I feel very, very hopeful, and other days I feel very frustrated, honestly. You know, one of the challenges is that, again, the wetlands that we lost, I would argue most of them were seasonally saturated, wet in the spring, wet in the wet times, dry the other times of the year. And a lot of the wetlands that are being reconstructed tend to be wetlands that hold water year-round. Right. And I think, you know, because they're more, you know, or they're lakes and ponds, you know, they're lakes and ponds.
There's something that's more appealing to people.
Correct.
And so we still have that interesting standard of what kind of wetland we value, even if we understand the importance in the ecosystem, Judy.
Yes. And I think it goes, I mean, some of that is our fault, because when we show wetlands, we tend to show a pond with a duck in it. Which is fine. Ponds and ducks are fine, but, you know, that's not, you know, we don't show a wetland with prairie, you know, with big prairie flowers, and we just don't think of, our mind's not there, so,
well,
or beautiful reeds.
Right. Judy Joyce, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Great. Thank you.
Judy Joyce is founder and president of Earthview Environmental Incorporated. She is a wetland scientist. Her company is located in Coralville. And Sherry Register, thank you so much. It must be exciting to connect with so many other people who are now telling you that they also care about this landscape.
Right. And I'm so glad to hear from somebody like Judy, because I get asked the questions that you ask Judy, and I don't know the answers because I'm not a scientist.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. Thanks a lot for being here. Sherry Register is the author of The Big Marsh, The Story of a Lost Landscape. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.